I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. Is Democracy Now!
Filing a lawsuit against the State Department to force it to finally enforce the Leahy Law and end military aid to abusive units of the Israeli Defense Forces.
Five Palestinian families are suing the U.S. State Department for violating the Leahy Law, which bars the U.S. government from funding foreign military units credibly implicated in gross human rights abuses. We'll speak with one of the plaintiffs and a former State Department official. Then to the sister and husband of Ayashnur Ezgi Aigi, the American human rights activist who just graduated from University of Washington, killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank this year. They're in Washington, D.C. to demand action.
I have been painfully ripped away from spending time in her memory and forced to sideline my grief in order to scrape and beg daily for the past 3 months to plead with the Biden administration to seek justice for my wife.
And then, as Donald Trump sues the Des Moines Register for publishing a poll before the election that showed him trailing Kamala Harris, we'll look at Trump's renewed war on the press.
I think you have to do it because they're very dishonest, and you need a fair press. And the press says, no, I see others. I have a few others that I'm doing.
As Trump calls the media the enemy of the people, we'll look at his suit against the Des Moines Register and his multi-million dollar settlement with ABC News. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Health officials in Gaza say Israeli attacks have killed at least 38 Palestinians and wounded more than 200 over the past 24 hours. Among the latest deaths were 10 Palestinians killed in an Israeli missile attack on the Shati refugee camp and two women killed when Israel shelled a home east of Khan Yunis. In northern Gaza, doctors were forced to close the intensive care unit at the besieged Kamal Adwan Hospital after an Israeli attack triggered a large fire. The UN's humanitarian office warns UN-led missions to supply northern Gaza continue to be overwhelmingly denied, with Israeli forces turning back three humanitarian aid convoys carrying food and water on Tuesday alone. Meanwhile, a senior Palestinian official involved in indirect negotiations for a ceasefire in Gaza said talks are in a decisive and final phase. News of a possible truce was welcomed by Gaza residents who've survived more than 15 months of Israel's assault.
Let them stop the war so we can live in peace and they can open the border crossing for us to bring in food and everything we need, flour, diapers and baby formula. Let them bring in everything for us.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers shot and killed two Palestinians near the town of Sofin on Tuesday. They were identified as 32-year-old Mohammed Ashkar and 31-year-old Dia Salmi. Israeli forces reportedly blocked anyone from approaching the wounded men, leaving them to bleed out before medical help could arrive. Israel's carried out near daily raids across the occupied West Bank, killing at least 800 Palestinians since October 2023 and arresting over 12,000. A United Nations envoy has warned Syria's civil war has not yet ended, despite the removal of President Bashar al-Assad by opposition fighters. On Tuesday, UN Syria envoy Geert Pedersen told the UN Security Council Turkish-backed armed groups are continuing to battle Kurdish groups for control of several areas of northern Syria. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department said it had brokered an extension of a ceasefire deal between Turkey and the U.S.-backed Kurdish-Syrian forces around the northern Syrian city of Manbij. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed that his forces will remain in Syria indefinitely after Israeli troops expanded their occupation beyond the Golan Heights. On Tuesday, Netanyahu and senior Israeli officials toured the peak of Syria's Mount Hermon, which Israeli troops seized after the fall of the Assad regime. The mountain on the border of Lebanon and Syria extends into and even beyond a UN-designated demilitarized buffer zone. This comes amidst growing international condemnation of Israel's plans to build new settlements in the Israeli-occupied parts of Syria, which are illegal under international law. Israeli military bulldozers have begun clearing land for new construction projects in the Golan Heights community of Majd al-Shams, where Druze residents condemn the surge in planned settlements.
Regarding this Israeli occupation, it is not surprising since Israel occupied Palestine and Sinai and occupied the Syrian Golan Heights and Lebanon that it is currently starting a new occupation. Behind us, you can see the digging, which the Israeli army is doing, which is against all international conventions.
Israel and Saudi Arabia have reached a breakthrough in talks that could soon result in an agreement to normalize relations between the two countries. That's according to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which reports the deal would see Saudi Crown Prince and de facto leader Mohammed bin Salman agree to a vague commitment to a path towards Palestinian statehood rather than an explicit recognition of a Palestinian state. Meanwhile, human rights groups are blasting the International Soccer Federation, FIFA, for selecting Saudi Arabia to host the 2034 Men's World Cup, citing the exploitation of migrant workers in Saudi Arabia, the jailing of political activists for expressing themselves peacefully, and discrimination against women and LGBTQ plus people. In a joint statement, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and others write, quote, "It's evident that without urgent action and comprehensive reforms, the 2034 World Cup will be tarnished by repression, discrimination, and exploitation on a massive scale," they wrote. The Biden administration's releasing three more prisoners from the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The Pentagon says Mohammed Farik bin Amin and Mohammed Nazir bin Lep will be transferred to their home country of Malaysia to serve an additional 5 years in prison after they pleaded guilty to participating in deadly bombing attacks in Indonesia in the early 2000s. Before they were sent to Guantanamo, both men were held at secret CIA black sites where they were tortured. The U.S. will also release another torture survivor, Mohammed Abdul Malik Bajabu, to Kenya after imprisoning him for 17 years at Guantanamo without trial. In a statement, Amnesty International welcomed the prisoners' release and called for the remaining 27 Guantanamo prisoners to be freed, writing, quote, "President Biden must transfer these men before he leaves office, or he will continue to bear responsibility for the abhorrent practice of indefinite detention without charge or trial by the U.S. government," unquote. President-elect Donald Trump has escalated his attacks on the press. On Tuesday, Trump filed a lawsuit against prominent pollster J.N. Seltzer for her polling firm Seltzer & Company, the Des Moines Register, and the newspaper's parent company, Gannett, alleging violations of the Iowa Consumer Fraud Act. Trump accuses them of, quote, brazen election interference, unquote, over a November 2nd poll that showed former Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris ahead of Trump by 3 points in Iowa. Trump claims news coverage of the poll just days before Election Day was intended to help Harris. Trump ended up winning Iowa with 56% of the vote. This comes after ABC News, which is owned by Disney, agreed to donate $15 million to Trump's presidential library to settle a defamation suit filed by the president-elect. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. On Capitol Hill, Democrats have selected Virginia Congressmember Jerry Connolly to serve as the party's ranking member on the House Oversight Committee. He won the role after defeating progressive Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez by a vote of 131-84 in a closed-door Democratic caucus meeting. The move rejected mounting calls to select a younger generation of lawmakers to serve in leadership positions following Democrats' disastrous performance in November's election. Connolly will be replacing Congressmember Jamie Raskin of Maryland, who will move on to become the top Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee when Congress convenes on January 3rd. Authorities in Mayotte are warning of the spread of hunger and disease after Cyclone Chido battered the Indian Ocean archipelago, leaving hundreds, if not thousands, of people dead. Amidst growing anger over France's slow response to the crisis, French President Emmanuel Macron announced he'll visit Mayotte on Thursday. Mayotte is France's poorest overseas territory. Survivors have described apocalyptic scenes in which ramshackle homes were completely blown away by 140-mile-an-hour winds.
It really is a war landscape. Around me, I don't recognize anything anymore. There's not even a tree left. On the hills, there's not even a blade of grass. It's impressive. There were multi-story houses, and everything is gone.
In Mozambique, authorities say at least 34 people were killed after Cyclone Chido made landfall on Sunday. In the South Pacific, at least 14 people were killed and hundreds more injured after a magnitude 7.3 earthquake struck off the island nation of Vanuatu Tuesday. A tsunami warning was called after the quake, but large aftershocks rattled survivors. The UN's Humanitarian Affairs Office estimates one-third of Vanuatu's population, or more than 100,000 people, have been affected. In media news, CNN is facing widespread backlash after the fact-checking group VerifySci and CNN's own investigation determined that a person interviewed on a CNN video report claiming to be a Syrian prisoner was actually a former intelligence officer in the Bashar al-Assad regime who once ran a notorious checkpoint in Homs. CNN's report shows journalist Clarissa Ward and her team stumbling upon the person under covers who has now been identified as former Syrian Air Force Lieutenant Salama Mohammed Salam, who claimed to have been held in a windowless cell for 3 months in a Damascus prison. We'll have more on media coverage later in the broadcast. Luigi Mangione, the suspect in the shooting death of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson in New York, has been charged with first-degree murder and second-degree murder as an act of terrorism. New York District Attorney Alvin Bragg announced the charges Tuesday, saying Mangione intended, quote, to sow terror. Bragg described the killing as a, quote, frightening, well-planned and targeted murder. 26-year-old Mangione is scheduled for another court hearing in Pennsylvania on Thursday to determine whether he'll be extradited to New York. To see our coverage of the story, go to democracynow.org. And in Greenland, the longtime anti-whaling and environmental activist Paul Watson has been released from a Danish-run jail after authorities rejected a request by Japan to extradite him. Watson was arrested in July as his ship docked in Greenland before setting off to the North Pacific on a mission to intercept a Japanese whaling vessel. Watson co-founded Greenpeace and is the founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, which takes nonviolent direct action to protect the world's oceans and marine life. Paul Watson spoke to reporters from Greenland's capital Nuuk after his release on Tuesday.
I'm very thankful. The president and the former prime minister of France have been extremely helpful. The president of Brazil has been, you know, intervened. Bernie Sanders, my senator, has actually been very helpful. The U.S. embassy has been very, very helpful also. And but really, the public pressure from all over the world, you know, I've received over 4,000 letters while I've been in prison, has been really overwhelming.
If extradited to Japan, Watson faced a possible sentence of up to 15 years in prison. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Five Palestinian families have sued the U.S. State Department for violating U.S. federal law by continuing to fund Israeli military units despite their role in gross human rights abuses in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. The lawsuit cites the Leahy Law, named after former Vermont Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy. The lawsuit says, quote, "The State Department's calculated failure to apply the Leahy Law is particularly shocking in the face of the unprecedented escalation since the Gaza war erupted on October 7, 2023," unquote. The lawsuit is supported by Dawn, the D.C.-based nonprofit that campaigns for democracy and human rights in the Arab world. This is a short clip from a video they produced about the lawsuit.
For almost 30 years, the Leahy Law has prohibited the United States from funding foreign security forces that violate human rights. Yet for decades, the United States has consistently ignored persistent and widespread abuses by the security forces of one country, Israel, and refused to block aid to any of its military units. Now Dawn is taking action. We are filing a lawsuit against the State Department to force it to finally enforce the Leahy Law and end military aid to abusive units of the Israeli Defense Forces. This lawsuit isn't just about ending the Israeli exception from enforcing U.S. laws, but preserving the broader principles of accountability, human rights, and the rule of law. We hope our lawsuit will force a long overdue reckoning for Israeli impunity, but also crack down on U.S. foreign policies arming abusive regimes around the globe, in violation of our nation's own laws and principles. This lawsuit also reflects the immense human cost of America's failure to enforce its own laws, continuing to provide Israel with over $20 billion in weapons to terrorize Palestinians in Gaza, where it has killed over 45,000 people, the vast majority women and children.
That video from the D.C.-based nonprofit Dawn that campaigns for democracy and human rights in the Arab world. We're joined now by two guests. Charles Blaha, a senior advisor to Dawn. He retired from the State Department last year after over 30 years of service. From 2016 until his retirement, he served as director of the Office of Security and Human Rights, which is responsible for implementing the Leahy Law worldwide. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. And from Philadelphia, we're joined by the Palestinian-American writer Ahmed Moore. Born in Gaza, Moore is one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, an advisory board member of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Charles Blaha. You work for the State Department, the agency that you are now suing, for over 30 years. Can you explain more fully the Leahy Law and what you're charging in this lawsuit?
Sure. And thanks for having me. The Leahy Law, as you said, prohibits United States assistance to security force units that have committed gross violations of human rights. It's actually very surgical. And it prohibits U.S. assistance to the specific units that have committed the violations. The State Department has for years in its own human rights reports, including the 2023 reports for Israel and for Gaza and the West Bank, set forth gross violations of human rights by Israeli security forces. Things like torture, extrajudicial killings, like the killing of Aisha Nur Ezgi Egi that you mentioned at the top. Deprived people of their liberty without due process. Rape under color of law. Enforced disappearances. These are allegations and credible reports set forth in the State Department's own human rights reports. And they go back years. Despite all that, the State Department has never once held any Israeli unit ineligible for assistance under the Leahy Law. The lawsuit, which is by the plaintiffs, is designed to try to compel the State Department to obey the law. So, in three words, what this lawsuit is about is the State Department must obey the law.
Well, Charles Blaha, what has happened to these reports once the department, once they've been issued to the higher ups in the State Department?
Well, that's a good question, because usually the determinations about whether a unit is eligible or not are not made at the higher levels of the State Department. They're made by experts. They're made by action officers who are versed in the Leahy Law, who know the security forces in question, and who know the facts in question. And these are legal determinations. And one of the problems with the way the Leahy Law is applied, or really not applied to Israel, is that these determinations have been made at the political level. And they have, as I said, resulted in not one single Israeli security force unit ever being found ineligible for assistance.
And how is U.S. military assistance delivered to Israel? In what form and where? And is this a standard practice, the way it's delivered?
Well, Israel is a special case, and we give massive security assistance to Israel. And part of that is a lump sum of over $3 billion annually that goes into an account. And where it goes after that is controlled by Israel. We don't know all the places it goes. We don't know the units it goes to. And that's a problem because the Leahy Law requires vetting units. In that situation where we can't trace the units to which the assistance is going, the law requires the State Department to give the countries in question, and Israel's one of those, there are a few others, to give the countries in question a list of ineligible units. The State Department has never done that. That has been the law since 2019, and in 5 years, the State Department has never given Israel a list of ineligible units. It's given lists to the other countries that this law applies to, but not to Israel.
Charles Blaha, you often hear commentators on television, or I should say U.S. government officials, saying, don't be so concerned about this amount of money, $3 billion, because it's really going mainly to U.S. military, you know, to the weapons manufacturers. You hear that not only around Israel, but other countries that get U.S. military aid. Can you explain what actually happens? And is Israel a separate case where you don't know where the money goes, but in other cases, we insist that the money stays with U.S. weapons manufacturers?
Well, part of the money does go to U.S. weapons manufacturers. Part of it actually goes to their competitors in Israel. But the problem from the Leahy Law is, regardless of where that money goes, this is U.S. taxpayer money that's going to weapons that are being used in gross violations of human rights, being used by units that commit gross violations of human rights. That's the problem.
And Blinken's role, your former, well, I don't know if you worked under him, but the Secretary of State. When did you retire exactly?
I retired in August 2023, so before October 7th. And when I retired, I was frustrated at the slowness of that the law of the implementation of the law. It wasn't the reason I retired. I retired because I had been in the State Department for 32 years and it was time to retire. But I was frustrated. But I became more and more frustrated as I saw mounting evidence of gross violations of human rights by Israeli security force units and nothing being done about them.
And did you have conversations with Blinken about it specifically?
No, I was an office director, so I was not what they call up on the seventh floor, up in the highest levels of the State Department. I was an office director, but an office director with really good knowledge of the Leahy Law and how it is applied.
I'd like to bring in to the conversation Ahmed Moore, is a Palestinian-American writer, advisory board member of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Welcome to Democracy Now! Could you talk about your involvement in the lawsuit? You were born in Gaza and still have family there?
Yes, that's right. So I was born in Gaza, moved to the United States as a child, still have most of my extended family in Gaza. And as you can imagine, conditions there have been unlivable for over a year, 14 months now. And so my direct participation in the lawsuit goes to my increasing inability and increasing likelihood, inability to speak with that family members in Gaza, and increasing likelihood that they're going to be subjected to further inhumane conditions and harm. My family's experienced direct loss through the genocide. Most recently, my cousin's 19-year-old son was killed by an Israeli sniper in Rafah. And so the urgency surrounding this lawsuit goes to the fact that the conditions are getting worse. The danger that people are exposed to continues even as we speak.
Ahmed, you wrote a piece recently in The Guardian. The Palestine-Israel nightmare won't end until we accept these basic truths. Lay out your argument.
So, I mean, basically anybody who's been, you don't need to be a sophisticated geopolitical analyst to take a look at a map and realize that there's never going to be a Palestinian state. The pronouncements that emerged in 1993, the White House lawn, the famous handshake between Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin, the Israeli prime minister at the time, did generate a lot of hope. You know, I lived as a child in the West Bank, and people were ready, I'd say, to accept a future of two states with everything that that entailed, with all of the losses that they'd experienced personally through the Nakba. At that time, Israel was less than 50 years old. People were ready to move on and accommodate themselves to the reality because Israel exists. But over the course of the past 30 years, the acceleration of the settlement project has basically rendered a Palestinian state unrealizable. And you really only need to take a look at how the settlements are arrayed across Jerusalem and the West Bank to realize that there's no contiguous Palestinian state possible in that land. And so people like me accommodated themselves to the idea of one binational state, equal rights for everybody. And it's the framework that we live under here in the United States, and it's workable in lots of different places. And we said, well, why not Palestine, Israel? That no longer seems likely or workable. You speak with people in Palestine, and they're deeply traumatized, and it's unreasonable to ask them to say, well, you know, can you have a shared future in this land with Israelis? So I think that the consensus that's emerging is that we need some kind of separation, even though two states is unworkable, and it's not clear where that goes. In the article, though, I highlight a few conditions that need to be met before we can arrive at a negotiated conclusion or outcome to this horrible nightmare that we've all been living for so long. The first is recognition that Hamas is an ordinary political party in the sense that it's native to the Palestinian struggle. Hamas was founded long after the establishment of the State of Israel, and it arose in direct opposition to the conditions of the occupation in Gaza. Before Hamas, the chief organization that was described as the terrorist and obstacle peace was the Palestine Liberation Organization. And of course, the PLO accommodated themselves to Israel, and that was the commencement of the Oslo process. So we know that this outright description of people as hardliners or as being fundamentally incompatible with the idea of negotiation and discussion just isn't true. The second element of the argument, so I guess the first one is Hamas is not going away. It's an indigenous party in Palestine. It's employed terrorist tactics, but that doesn't mean that the party itself is going away or that Palestinian society is going to move away from Hamas just because the United States and Israel demand that it does. The second part of the argument is that that the Palestinians have a right to say that Zionism have the right to say that Zionism is Jewish supremacy in Palestine, and that in order for us to have an equitable conversation about what a future looks like, we need to move past Jewish supremacy in Palestine. We need a basic framework for negotiation and discussion, which moves past the idea that certain people have rights that accrue to them based on an identity, which is immovable, an identity that you're born with. And that's basically the argument. So once we meet these, once we can set a framework, basically, for negotiation and discussion, we can begin to talk about resolving the Palestinian-Israeli crisis. Where we go from there, I'm not sure. I don't think anybody really knows at this stage.
Yeah, I'd like to bring Charles Blaha back into the conversation. Charles, what differentiates this lawsuit from previous ones, against the U.S. government for providing military assistance to Israel, especially in lieu of the fact that Israel, with every war, Israel gobbles up more territory, creates more settlements, and becomes more and more of a rogue state?
Well, what makes this this particular lawsuit by the plaintiffs different are two things. One, it's being brought under the Administrative Procedures Act, and And the contention under that act is that the special process that the State Department uses to Leahy vet Israeli units, it's called the Israeli Leahy Vetting Forum, that that process is arbitrary and capricious and does not advance the intent of the Leahy Law. In fact, it seems designed to frustrate it. And the second thing about this lawsuit